Raw emotion in the Kyrgyz capital. The people of this small Central Asian country stunned by the scale of the violence. It broke out as opposition supporters took to the streets of the capital, demanding that the president resign.
Kyrgyzstan was Central Asia's most democratic republic with its most open economy. Now, its south has been devastated by ethnic violence between the Kyrgyz and their ethnic Uzbek neighbours.
For almost two decades, Kyrgyzstan appeared to be an oasis of democracy in Central Asia. In the last 4 months, that idea has been turned on its head. In April, the president was ousted from office in a bloody uprising. 2 months later, the south of Kyrgyzstan erupted into ethnic violence. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and today on Rear Vision, here on ABC Radio National, the story behind the current crisis in Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan is one of five nations carved out of Central Asia by the Soviets in 1924. Because of its position in the centre of Asia, it's strategically important to both Russia and America. It has the dubious honour of being the only nation on Earth to host military bases for both nations. The American base, which opened after 2001, is one of the US's main supply lines for the war in Afghanistan. To understand the current political turmoil and the ethnic conflict, you need to look at Kyrgyzstan's geography and history. Eugene Husky is Professor of Political Science and Director of Russian Studies at Stetson University in Florida.
Kyrgyzstan is right in the middle of Asia. It's surrounded on the east by China, the north by Kazakhstan, the west by Uzbekistan, and the south by Tajikistan. It's a very mountainous country. About 95% of the country is mountainous. So communications and transportation have been quite difficult over the centuries. And it means that it's an isolated place, and it's in a really disadvantageous location in terms of its access to the sea and the ease with which one can get out of the country, even by rail and by road. And it also makes communication inside the country between north and south very difficult. The two major cities, Bishkek in the north and Osh in the south, are separated by very high mountains that are impassable during the winter.
Until the end of the 19th century, Kyrgyzstan, like the rest of Central Asia, was home to two very different political and cultural groupings. Dr. Kirill Nurjanov is from the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University.
Central Asia was divided loosely into two categories of entities, political entities. On the one hand, there were three Khanates, so more or less established states, kind of feudal states with despotic rulers in charge. And on the other hand, there were nomadic tribes who recognized no overarching authority. And basically, ethnic Uzbeks belonged to the former category of political entities. They were sedentarized. They lived in cities. They tilled land. They paid taxes. They fought in regular armies. Whereas the Kyrgyz belonged to the nomadic peoples, and they recognized no state authority but the authority of their own khans, their own tribal leaders.
This all changed at the end of the 19th century with the arrival of the Russians.
The Russians came into Central Asia by way of systematic conquest in 1864. First the Tsars and then the communist authorities dismantled the pre-existing structures of authority and put in place something different. In the first instance, it was the colonial governorship general of Turkestan, and then after the Bolsheviks took over, Central Asia was divided into five Soviet socialist republics, Kyrgyzstan being one of them.
In 1924-25, there was a very important delimitation of the borders where not just the political authorities, but anthropologists and ethnographers and local politicians got together and sort of negotiated or carved out the boundaries of the five stans, the five Soviet stans. Essentially, they divided the borders on ethno-linguistic bases. So they tried to get people from the same ethnic linguistic group within one republican boundary. But they didn't succeed completely. And it would have been very difficult because it would have given Uzbekistan an extremely prominent position. And so what they did was to leave a number of ethnic Uzbeks in the surrounding republics.
In 1924, the Kyrgyz, who were traditionally nomadic, were in the majority, while the Uzbeks, who were traditionally sedentary, made up about 12% of the population and lived mostly in the south. According to Azkat Dukumbayev from the American University in Bishkek, the Soviets modernized northern Kyrgyzstan, but not the south, where most Uzbeks lived.
Soviets modernized the country. Before the Soviets, the lifestyle here was very nomadic, pre-modern, traditional. And the Soviets brought modernization and they built infrastructure. The communists brought education, industrialization, factories, plants were built. So Kyrgyzstan was modernized, but the problem is it was modernized mostly in the north. Kyrgyzstan is geographically divided by a range of mountains to the north and south. So the north happened to be mostly populated by Russians, and it was heavily industrialized, while the south of Kyrgyzstan historically belonged to Fergana Valley, remained traditional and less industrialized.
Yes, it's an often overlooked aspect of Soviet rule in Central Asia, because in the West, people tend to put the label of colonialism or neocolonialism on the Bolshevik, on the communist domination in the region. And yet there were some very tangible achievements during this time, and industrial development and education, basically social welfare. And it always surprises me whenever I go to Central Asia how people are nostalgic, not so much after Stalin or after Lenin, who are regarded, of course, as tyrants, but after Brezhnev. So in the collective historical memory of all Central Asian peoples, it's the period in the 1960s and 1970s that is still viewed as the golden age, when everyone had a job, when kids could go to schools and universities without paying anything, when basically you could travel everywhere within Central Asia or within the USSR at large. Nobody would care what kind of nationality you carried in your passport. And it's also quite striking the way people in Central Asia view Gorbachev. He's an absolute villain.
In Moscow, the Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has opened the historic 19th conference of the Communist Party. His marathon 3.5-hour speech called for a radical restructuring of the political system.
Mr. Gorbachev has laid before the delegates a proposal to return the Soviet Union to the path of true Leninism.
Soviet Prime Minister Nikolai Ryzhkov has declared President Gorbachev's policy of perestroika, or restructuring, a failure, and has indicated he will align himself with hardline communists and military leaders.
There are quite a few misconceptions about perestroika in the West. For people in the West, perestroika means democratization, openness, perhaps relaxation of international tension. For quite a few people, not just in Central Asia, but also in Russia, perestroika means political chaos and authoritarian rule and breakdown of law and order. Just the final comment I would like to make here is that Central Asia is unique in the former Soviet space in that at no point in time there was a coherent national independence movement. The Central Asians, the Uzbeks, the Kyrgyz, and all others did not want to get out of the Soviet Union, unlike, say, the Ukrainians or the Georgians. Life was good for them. But for Gorbachev, they would have stayed happily within the USSR.
There they are, the first chimes of 1992 in what was the Soviet Union and is now, as we all know, the new Commonwealth of Independent States. A magnificent firework display has just begun. Right above the Kremlin.
The USSR disappeared overnight, and the Central Asian political elites and the incumbent leaders acquired independence by default. So now it's autumn 1991, all those socialist Soviet symbols are out of the window, and the elites of Central Asia face a population that is anything but consolidated nations. Again, if we have a look at the originally nomadic tribal populations in Central Asia, such as the Kazakhs and the Kyrgyz, they were tribal. At no point in time before the Soviet period, they constituted an ethnicity, a nation. It's just a loose coalition of tribes or tribal agglomerations who sometimes make a pact to deal with an external enemy, but the normal situation for them would be internecine warfare. Thus, when we talk about Kyrgyzstan after 1991, the independent Kyrgyzstan, we're not talking about a consolidated nation, we're talking about northern Kyrgyzstan and southern Kyrgyzstan. And the northern Kyrgyz and southern Kyrgyz do not like each other. They used to fight war with each other all the time. Moreover, Kyrgyzstan can also be divided into seven distinct regions, and each region has its own mentality, its own traditions, its own power elite, and they don't really like each other. Thus, in 1991, the leader of Kyrgyzstan, Askar Akayev, had really a monumental task, how to forge this loose coalition of warring tribes, plus the whole bunch of ethnic minorities. All these people, they do not have any allegiance to the newly independent nation of Kyrgyzstan. Their fidelity goes to Mother Russia or to some other entity beyond the frontiers of Kyrgyzstan. This is a really dramatic picture, but I think it explains quite vividly what kind of challenges Kyrgyzstan and other Central Asian republics had to face after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
You're with Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're taking a look at the history of the small central nation of Kyrgyzstan, which for the last few months has been paralysed by political turmoil and ethnic tension. Kyrgyzstan took a very different political path from its neighbours when it gained its independence in 1991.
Kyrgyzstan was a little bit different from the surrounding Soviet Central Asian republics because in the rest of the republics, there was a rather neat continuity from the Soviet to the post-Soviet era where first secretaries of the communist parties morphed into presidents of post-communist countries. In the case of Kyrgyzstan, they had appointed at the end of the Soviet era a very reform-oriented head of the country in October 1990 and then reelected this time with a popular mandate as opposed to simply indirectly by the parliament in 1991, a man named Askar Akayev. President Akayev was much more democratically oriented, much more interested in open and pluralistic politics, and much more open to the West than his neighbors were. And so in the early 1990s, what we find in Kyrgyzstan is an attempt to integrate the country economically and politically with the West. And of course, there was one other reason, and that was that he realized they had very little to sell to the rest of the world. Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, particularly Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, could sell oil and gas. Kyrgyzstan sold its reputation as a democratic oasis in the authoritarian region of Central Asia. And the West received this gladly, and they began to support financially and otherwise Kyrgyzstan in the early 1990s. In 1994, however, we begin to see President Akayev move towards authoritarianism, gradually at first, but by the end of the decade, and certainly by 2000, a soft authoritarian regime was in place in Kyrgyzstan, where elections were fraudulent, the media was prevented from having open competition during electoral campaigns. Opposition candidates were disqualified for office. Journalists were detained. The usual methods used by authoritarian rulers, although again, a softer authoritarianism in Kyrgyzstan than we saw in the neighboring countries.
According to Askat Jukenbaev, throughout his presidency, Askar Akayev used the judiciary and the constitution to consolidate power in the office of the presidency.
He used judicial institutions and other state institutions to gain power, and increasingly he strengthened the presidency at the expense of the parliament. Later he started to prosecute independent journalists and opposition members. Kyrgyzstan, underneath of the modern institutions, we still have clans and tribal affiliations. Askar Akayev represents the northern clans and the more developed, industrialized, more Russified north, while the south of Kyrgyzstan, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union, as economic situation across the country declined, in the south, it worsened even more. Increasingly, all the power and, as a result, all the wealth got concentrated in the north, which caused discontent of the southern tribes. But again, yes, Askar Akayev used all those modern institutions to gain more power in the country.
He, in many ways, gave the most active sections of the Kyrgyz population a vent to have a semblance, to have an illusion that they participate in public life, that make all the decisions, because in reality, of course, all power was concentrated in his hands. As the president, he ruled by decree, and to a point he tolerated indeed the freedom of discussion, the presence of the opposition, but when the chips were down, when he was on the verge of making a critical strategic decision, he was his own boss. He never consulted with anybody. So this sort of soft authoritarianism lasted until 2005. And the undoing of Askar Akayev was not so much the groundswell of this democratic opposition who finally saw through the veil of authoritarianism and understood that Akayev was manipulating of them. No, it was, again, an age-old affair that the president, by 2005, had managed to antagonize the majority of clan leaders of ethnic Kyrgyz. Askar Akayev hailed from the north of the country, from a place not far away from the capital city of Bishkek. So being a northerner, he gave all the lucrative position in his administration and eventually all regional governorships to members of his own clan. And this antagonized the clans from the south of the country and from the west of the country, who got together one fine day and decided, well, enough is enough, and let's organize a little rotation in the highest corridors of power.
Kyrgyzstan's administration has apparently collapsed in spectacular fashion overnight after thousands of opposition supporters battled riot police and stormed government headquarters.
Protesters charged baton-wielding police in violent and bloody scenes before seizing control of government headquarters. The uprising follows claims recent parliamentary elections were manipulated.
When Askar Akayev was removed from his position in 2005, it was not an outbreak of some kind of democratic revolution. It was not a spontaneous protest by people driven to the edge of existence by unwise economic policies, by corruption, by lack of opportunity. It was an elite coup d'etat, plain and simple. Elites, of course, structured along tribal clan lines.
Kyrgyz opposition leader Kurmanbek Bakayev has been appointed both acting president and prime minister by the Central Asian Nations Parliament.
It was essential in 2005, during the Tulip Revolution, that a president come from the south. If you looked around at the landscape, Kurmanbek Bakayev was the most likely politician, a prominent southerner who had served as prime minister under Akayev in the early 2000s, had been, in fact, earlier on in the Soviet era, a member and a prominent personality in the Communist Party. And so this was a man who didn't necessarily have a huge amount of support throughout the country, but a person who was a logical compromise figure to become the president of Kyrgyzstan.
Just as Akayev was first and foremost a spokesperson for his own clan from the north of the country, Bakayev was a spokesperson for his own clan, this time from the south of the country, from the Jalalabad region. The difference between Akayev and Bakayev is really that of time. It took Akayev, well, close to 15 years to monopolize power and to degenerate into a venal, corrupt ruler who took care only of his own kith and kin. For Bakayev, the process, this slippery path, unfolded much faster. It took him less than 3 years to really consolidate his personal rule and to start putting all other clans into dark corners and monopolizing access to lucrative businesses in the country, first and foremost gold mining industry, and then, of course, he capitalized grandly from the presence of the American military base in the Republic of Kyrgyzstan.
The government of the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan, which is to the north of Afghanistan, has approved the closure of a U.S. airbase on its territory. Kyrgyz President Kurmanbek Bakayev has said Washington has not come up with a satisfactory deal to stay, but some analysts believe the rift is more about strategic maneuvering in Central Asia between the U.S. and Russia.
Russia becomes alienated by the brazenness of Bakiyev, by his, and here I'll have to explain that in early 2009, Bakiyev had gone to Moscow to receive a $2 billion loan from Russia and several hundred million dollars in aid on top of that. In exchange for that, Medvedev expected Bakiyev to throw out the United States and the West from the base at Manas. Bakiyev did not keep his promise and, in fact, renegotiated the arrangements with the United States for the base and tripled the price for the lease. And in addition, promised to open an anti-terrorist base of the United States in the southern city of Osh. So there was that reason and others that the Russians felt terribly alienated. And on March 23rd, for the first time, they began to broadcast television news reports that were highly critical of Bakiyev and his family, attacking them for corruption and cronyism. And let's recall that this is still a Russian-speaking part of the world. Even though people may speak Kyrgyz as their first language, they oftentimes watch the Russian news. And so this was a kind of signal to the opposition forces in Kyrgyzstan, which had been building over the preceding months, that it was time to strike.
Kyrgyzstan has observed a day of mourning for more than 70 people who were killed in a bloody uprising earlier this week.
The people of this small Central Asian country stunned by the scale of the violence. It broke out as opposition supporters took to the streets of the capital, demanding that the president resign. They're furious about huge price increases.
There were a range of events that started, I would say, with the declining economic circumstances in the area of the former Soviet Union. But there were also some specific policies that were taken by the Bakiyev regime that undermined the legitimacy of his government. These would include the raising of utility rates dramatically at the beginning of 2010, so that you had electric rates doubling. The population understood that the Bakiyev family was involved in the utility companies. And so it was in a way seen, to put it simply, as the taking of money out of the pockets of ordinary people, who were in many cases impoverished, and putting it right into the pockets of the ruling elite, a family that had not just a president in power, but really was almost a dynastic system with two sons with prominent positions in the government and six brothers as well.
As they approached government buildings, the security forces opened fire. Today, the leader of the new interim government warned the violence may not be over.
If we look at the people who are now in charge in Kyrgyzstan, these are all familiar faces. Roza Otunbayeva and 14 members of your provisional government are all apparatchiks who served with distinction under Akayev and then under Bakiyev. They are all clan leaders in their own right.
Ethnic violence is worsening in the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan. Now, fighting between members of the Uzbek and Kyrgyz ethnic groups has left nearly 80 people dead and 1,000 injured. The interim government has given security forces shoot-to-kill powers to stop the fighting.
Well, it's quite clear the main reason for the brutal cleansing, for thousands of deaths and hundreds of thousands of internally displaced people in the south of Kyrgyzstan, was the sheer weakness of the provisional government of Roza Otunbayeva. The regions of Osh and Jalalabad in Kyrgyzstan belong to the Fergana Valley in Central Asia, and this is easily one of the most overpopulated areas on this planet. So the competition for these resources, for land and water, between ethnic Uzbeks and ethnic Kyrgyz is absolutely ferocious. This is the primary reason for the ethnic strife in 2010.
This was a revolution made in the north by northerners. And so many people in the south are a little bit reluctant to accept the legitimacy of the regime. And therefore, the former president and his allies, only a month after the revolution took place, in May 13th, in the southern city of Jalalabad, mobilized large numbers of ethnic Kyrgyz against the interim government. they had great difficulty putting down that revolt. They did it only with the support of local ethnic Uzbeks. And this actually alienated, as you might expect, a number of ethnic Kyrgyz in the south.
According to the official view of this crisis, the tragedy of June this year was inspired and organized by pro-Bakiyev's forces. And I tend to believe that the conflict was inspired, instigated by the forces that wanted to undermine the legitimacy of the current interim government. But we should look deeper how happened that Kyrgyz-Uzbek relations tend to be the weakest link in the politics in Kyrgyzstan. Because we believe over the 20 years, those issues were not addressed. The first president's policies failed to bring the regions together. Askar Akayev failed to develop the south of Kyrgyzstan, and he failed to address those growing inter-ethnic and social economic problems in the south. So the causes of the June tragedy certainly lay deeper, and the instigators just used it for their political aims.
At the end of June, the people of Kyrgyzstan overwhelmingly passed a referendum to change the political system from a presidency to a parliamentary democracy.
On this historic day, all of us, the citizens of Kyrgyzstan, will have to make probably our most important choice of the past years.
The referendum proposed a parliamentary republic with a strong prime minister. The president's powers will be curtailed, and Otunbayeva will remain in office until the end of 2011. As expected, the referendum appears to have passed. The Elections Commission says the turnout exceeded 60%.
The referendum calls for the introduction of parliamentary elections in October, on October 10th, and that will then introduce a parliamentary government which will have a prime minister who should take the lead role in Kyrgyz politics. Let me quickly add, however, that this is not a traditional parliamentary republic, even though the Kyrgyz call it that. It's really much more like a semi-presidential system of the sort that you have in Ireland, where there is an elected president, because the president from in the future is going to be popularly elected. The president also has the right to control the institutions in the area of defense and law enforcement. So this is going to make for a very interesting kind of dual game in Kyrgyz politics following the October elections.
In terms of high politics, I don't have much hope for Kyrgyzstan. It's not going to become a mature democracy with a great level of tolerance and respect for all sorts of minorities anytime soon. On the anthropological level, I do believe that the potential for stabilization is there, that local Uzbeks and Kyrgyz living in the south of the country, in Osh and Jalalabad, can negotiate with each other, can reach some kind of accommodation. It will be a very tense accommodation, but accommodation nonetheless. The main thing, of course, is that the new government, whatever government it is, whether it's Roza Otunbayeva or whoever replaces her, does not interfere into grassroots politics. Because it is, my opinion, with the benefit of the hindsight, quite evident that the myopic policies of the regime in Bishkek contributed to the violence and the escalation. Because all the previous governments ended up being very nationalistic, very pro-Kyrgyz and very anti-Uzbek. And I dare say that there are disturbing signs that the government, the provisional government of Roza Otunbayeva, is no different.
Kirill Nozhanov from the Centre of Arab and Islamic Studies at ANU in Canberra. Today's other guests were Eugene Husky, Director of Russian Studies at Stetson University in Florida, and Azkat Dukumbayev from the American University in Bishkek. Thanks to sound engineer Judy Rapley and to ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for joining us.
On the Law Report, should female prisoners have access to IVF? A Victorian court has just given one prisoner the go-ahead. Also, Australia's National Radioactive Waste Facility, the proposed site's on Aboriginal land. One group of traditional owners nominated the site, and a whole lot of others are furious. The opponents are off to court to strike out what they say was a flawed nomination process. That's on The Law Report with me, Damien Carrick, and you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.